I don't really know quite why I chose this topic. I never really know what I'm going to talk about, you know, much ahead. But I thought I'd talk about this topic because I studied it in depth once and found it so unbelievably revealing that I thought I would share it with you. And it's basically the main part of this material is the experience we have of doubt. So it's so huge. It's so sneakily huge. Like, you don't think doubt's a big deal. You say, yeah, I know doubt. Yep. And then on to the next thing, something juicier. But actually, it's huge. So I think it's worth getting familiar with. Uh-oh. Is this scarf, do you think, that's making it rattle? Or it just rattles. I think it just rattles anyway. Okay. So first of all, who here is not familiar, and I don't mean just have heard this, but actually is familiar. Who is not familiar with the hindrances? Not familiar. Couple of you, only a couple of you. So the rest of you, you actually really live with these hindrances as your extended family and you know them well? So that's what I mean by familiar, extended family. We need to really be familiar with them for them to actually be useful in our practice, to recognize them. So even though there's very few of you who are not familiar with the term of them, what we want to consider is that there are these forces that happen in our minds which interfere with our being awakened beings. So any of us who happen not to be completely awake right now are being hindered somehow. Anybody that applies to, maybe? So these things are like what get in the way of clarity in our awareness. And clarity means an awareness that sees completely clearly and truly and deeply and cares completely truly for whatever is being seen, inside and outside, in self, in other, in life, in beings. So clarity is a great word for an awakened state. And what inhibits an awakened state in us is any of these five forces. And usually they're operational in us to some extent or another a lot of the time. And usually more than one, usually three, and sometimes four. You can't have five, you can only have four. So, even there are five of them. So just to let you know, those who aren't familiar, wanting, a state of wanting anything is the first one. Wanting anything to be slightly better than this, wanting to be slightly ahead of this moment, like tonight's gonna be better once we get home again, that kind of wanting some improvement over anything at all, in the big picture of your life, when I retire, in my case, when I, you know, pay the mortgage, whatever, whatever, any tiny little, when I get that chocolate, you know, after I've had a good night's sleep, any of those massive rate is some wanting, meaning not completely peaceful, clear, fine, open, and fully accepting and at ease with right this now, what is. Does that apply to anybody here? Its opposite is not wanting. Is this, you know, they go hand in glove, because if you want something, you don't want what's here then. So, you know, you can have them both going on together. It's like, I don't want this knee pain, I want to be free of this knee pain. It's the sort of same, you know, I want to have a good night's sleep because I don't want to be tired. You know, they're sort of sort of mirror images of the same thing. So they're together very often. You can't have one without the other one lurking underneath it, right? And so any form, and there's, in our experience, we are usually more preoccupied or covered with, is it me or is it? Or is there something I should do differently? Is this thing? Bend it down a little bit. It's my breath. Okay. Thank you, Jonathan. yeah, aversive things. We actually have a lot of, you know, we may be wanting something, but it's the what we don't like. You know, we're fed up with this, or frustrated by this, or worried by this, or angry about this, or hurt about this, or scared of this, or judging this, whining about this, anything. There's so we have a lot, we're wired for negativity way more than the positivity on the whole. So there's usually a lot of that hindrance in our consciousness at any moment. Even when we think everything's fine, it's sort of okay, not quite perfect. I mean, to be in an awakened state, this has to be it. This moment is absolutely it. This is my life in its complete fullness. It's never going to get better than this. This is, I'm here, I've arrived, this is it, we're here. Are we all there yet? Right, well, there's something. One or two or three of these hindrances are happening. The next two are also a pair, but you can't have one, you can only have one of these pairs because they're opposite. And one is the state of any degree of restlessness or anxiety or agitation or squirminess or not quite able to settle and just be fully here, which is most of us most of the time, especially modern era, urban life, you know, engaged, stimulated, overstimulated, overstimulated. Every time you look in a screen, that jumpy anything. I know that applies to every one of us here all the time. So to actually have moments of quietude of without that feeling is like, it's remarkable. In fact, people do this when they go into retreat. They actually have a lack of stimulus and they begin to relax and they completely pass out with a sleep because they're exhausted, because they don't know how to actually function without all of the stimulus. We get so used to it. Agitation and often not just the stimulating kind of agitation, but feelings of remorse or feelings of like, oh, or worry, you know, that kind of thing. And it causes that squirmy distress to some degree. Any of these things is shrinking feelings, is agitation. And its opposite is like no energy or dull energy or like collapsing energy. Not engagedness, disconnectedness, drifting, vague, dull, dreary, depressed, you know. Not caring. There's a whole, you know, huge range of this one too. But if you have that, you won't have the agitation. You can swing from one to the other quite quickly, but you can't have them both at the same time. And huge different amounts of like, oh, life's such a drag, anything burdensome, the weight of depression, the weight of sadness, all of those things that checking out, not wanting to deal with, despair, whatever it may be. So that's that one. And then the fifth one is doubt, what I want to talk about tonight. Now doubt, it's so sneaky. It's hard to get a handle on it. It's one of the things about doubt is that it's there if any of the others are there. The others aren't always there. There could be more of one or the other. But doubt, when you start looking for it, you start getting familiar with it, which is my beginning conversation, was get familiar with these things, because there's no way you can become conscious and clear and free of them until you recognize them. You have to know them, and you have to know when they're there and that they're operating in you so that they can be, you don't just sort of hope to wake up one day. You know, it can happen to the occasional lucky person, but it's very fluky. Whereas the rest of us, we actually need to enable it. And the reason we enable awakening, moments of awakening, even little mini moments of awakening, is we need to realize what's inhibiting them. So we need to get familiar with these forces in us. So doubt is always there when in those moments that we're not okay. Because doubt is... I'm going to get into what it is in just a second, but first of all, it's very sneaky, very pervasive, all over the place. You have to start watching out for it. But the other thing about it is, and I'll describe why it shows up when you don't realize it's there, is that it's got this... I'm not finishing this sentence. I'm going to finish this sentence, I promise. When any of the hindrances are functioning in us, we are stimulated in our thinking. We're busy. we've got to do something, got to get the something, get rid of the something. We're not comfortable enough to be here, so something has to happen. And when we're dull, even though there's not a lot of energy, there is a sense of being separate from the world. There isn't the joyful connectedness of a moment much more of awakened clarity. So there's something missing. With doubt, when doubt is there, the manifestation of doubt in the form of the thinking which we do when in these states, there's not peace in there, there's some disturbance going on. The disturbance that is attenuated to doubt, most often why we don't recognize it, is wisdom. We think that it's really clever. We have a sense of like, oh, I don't think that's a good idea. And we listen to it because we believe it, because it's really believable, because it's convincing that it's reliable. Whereas wanting, for instance, when you're wanting, you say, oh, I've got to get that chocolate. And you have some consciousness about it. You know perfectly well that you don't have to have that chocolate. It's just a thing your mind is saying, and it's kidding you that I will be happier when. And it's easier to see it as a meditator. It's easier to see yes. And not just see, but recognize, oh, wanting. The same thing with resisting. It's obvious. It's like resisting is I'm struggling against what's happening. I'm not liking it. I'm in some conflict here or some state of resistance and stress, and I'm not at ease and at peace and okay with. It's recognizable. And so when I think those critical thoughts or those judgmental thoughts, I know that I'm caught in my being resisting, and I know I'm not in a moment of freedom, and I can recognize that, and hopefully I can realize, and it loses its grip. Agitation, similarly, dullness is pretty obvious. It's just low energy in different manifestations. But doubt, you don't think of it as a hindrance. We don't think of it as like interfering with my clarity. It's actually helping my clarity, so it's very convincing. It's like, this isn't a good idea, this would be better if you did this, or better take a second chance, a second look at this, I'm not quite sure. So it's cautionary, but it's very convincing. So we very easily fall for its story, whereas the other's not so convincing. So that's why it's so sneaky and so hard to get a handle on, and so hard to be freed from. When doubt is in us, what happens to us is we hesitate. We're like, I'm not sure if I should do this or this, or I don't know. There's confusion, there's hesitancy, there's caution, there's a hanging back, there's sometimes anxiety, it doesn't feel strong, it doesn't feel, I'm trying to avoid the words which are its opposite, but actually I'm going to have to go for the opposite. The easiest way to recognize any of these hindrances, and as we meditate, it's really a skillful form of meditation, is to look for the opposite of whatever the thing is you're exploring, and this really works well with hindrances. So if you're wanting to recognize, is the hindrance wanting manifesting in my life right now? What does it feel like when I don't want? And we know that. When we don't want anything, we're really content. We're really peaceful. Ah, this is great. We relax. Compared to, this isn't so relaxing, I really want something, da-da-da-da. We're wound up in comparison. We use the opposite as a way to compare, and that gives us a better reference to the hindrance. Am I making sense? So we can think about them, but thinking about it, of course, doesn't help on the path. We have to practice it, experience it. So remind yourself to experience the lack of it, and then you'll recognize more fully the actuality and the experience of being caught in one of these hindrances. So when I'm serene and peaceful, I'm not agitated. Gosh, when I am serene and peaceful, those few times when I am, agitation really is horrible. You know, it's like really, it's exhausting, isn't it? And I can see that more clearly when I'm actually at least remembering not to be that way, or those times when I'm not that way. So with doubt, when we get to doubt, the opposite of doubt, and we're using our minds as a way to consider and reflect, this is sort of reflective part of our meditation, to choose to think about, okay, what is doubt? So when I don't have doubt, what's here? What's that? What is that state? Well, the state is actually trust. Okay, so let me think about this for a bit. When I'm trusting, what's that like? I really like it. You know, when I trust a person, isn't that feel great? When you can trust somebody? And when you can't trust them? Da-da-da-da-da, comes the music on the movie. Uh-oh, danger here, right? It's like, whoopsie, be careful, tension. Trusting, it's like, oh, they were there when they said they were going to be there. You're there, it's so reassuring. It gives us a sense of solidity. When there's a sense of something solid that we can, that's ground, we can relax. When it's not there, I better watch out, right? See what I'm saying? Or when we trust ourselves, it's like, we have confidence. Yes, I can do this thing. Yes, I will be able to handle this situation. But when we're going into a situation and we don't trust that we can handle it, it's scary, we don't know how to deal. Am I going to be able to, what shall I say? We're rehearsing, you know, we're trying to remember our lines or run possible scenarios so that we can do it appropriately and all of those kinds of things, right? It's not restful. It's not comfortable. And of course, our little mind, which is rehearsing, is we're thinking it's helping us, and it is helping us, but you can see there's dukkha there, struggle, stress, anxiety. I want to think of these hindrances, how they actually affect our meditation. I mean, they affect our lives in everything we do, in every way, every moment, every meeting, every event we got to deal with. We're either clearly with it, open to it, caring about it, available for it, connected with it, them, whatever, moments of more freedom, or we're hindered in some way. We want something from the person, or we're scared of that contact, or what they just said. Hindrances functioning all over the place. But how about looking at our meditation practice through the lens of what these hindrances are there? The one doubt is the one I'm interested in. When we're doubting our meditation, happens a lot for lots of us. Can you tell me some of the ways it shows up? I'll give you a couple of examples and then see if you can. It's like, oh, I don't think I'm going to be able to get my mind here tonight. Is that, anybody thought a thought like that when you go to sit? Other things that you think that undermine your sitting that could be doubt? Can you say them, anyone? I don't have time, exactly.
I'm worried I might fall asleep.
Exactly, I might fall asleep. Can't do it because I'll probably fall asleep.
Why bother?
Well, yeah, why bother, absolutely.
Not knowing which object.
Yes, how to meditate. I don't know if I know what to do. What am I supposed to do with this? Like, how do I, now what am I supposed to do?
Just feeling restful.
Yeah. Yeah, like, can't connect at all, right? So, and you believe them. I don't think I can do this because I haven't got time, because I don't know what to do, so I'm going to quit. Or my mind is, I remember really a strong one for me, which changed, which is why I remember it. I didn't recognize it all the time, however many years, 15 years, that I was like, I've got to really concentrate. I must, no thinking, no. I didn't trust that if I just sat back and observed it, that my mind would stay there. I absolutely thought I have to keep it on a really short lead, this little mind, or it's going to go all over the place. I had no trust that my mind was becoming trained and that if I, you know, wanted to pay attention to something, that it would. So I thought I had to apply great force, completely doubting, right? So, but there's many other manifestations of doubt in our meditation. That it is actually worthwhile. That's like a huge one. Is it actually going to make the slightest difference whether I sit down now and watch my breath for 15 minutes? We don't have faith in the effectiveness of it, in the worthwhileness of it, the value of it. At least we have some. But the point where this is interesting in meditation is the more trust we have in the process, the more energy we put into doing it and the more effective it is. The less we are convinced of its value, the more ho-hum we are in of the way we do it, and therefore the less use it is. Because the less meaningful it is, because the less we're bothering to apply ourselves. It requires a considerable amount of faith, trust, commitment to do it. And so it really is important in terms of being a practitioner how much doubt is actually showing up. So you want to be able to recognize it, even though it sounds very convincible, very convincing, very believable. We have, I think one of the main manifestations of doubt for those who aren't so familiar with looking at it and recognizing it is the inability to take the next step. It's like hesitancy, stuckness, like that feeling. It's useful to recognize it, manifestation. To hear words is reasonably useful. To actually recognize it showing up energetically is really, that's where it's useful. So for yourself, you need to be able to recognize what's going on, when doubt is happening, what is happening. When we're in a state of doubting, there is a little voice. Going on. Chat, 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 sort of like, don't know what to do. It's like that, for me, that's what it's like. I don't know if it's like that in everybody's head, but it's certainly like that in mine. And that little voice that's da-da-da-da-da is saying something like, something, something, I should, something, something. There's I in that speaking. The sense of self that has to do something is happening. On the other hand, when there's a moment of trusting, one of the reasons why trusting is such a beautiful thing is that little da-da-da-da-da shuts up, and then the little I have to something isn't doing it. So that self-ing is in abeyance in that moment. Making sense? So when we are doubting and lost in doubting and not realizing we're doubting, there's I. There's a sense of lack of contentment because it's got to do something, it's a tension, there's struggle. There's often a jumping around because maybe this, maybe this, maybe this. What about that? No, I don't know, maybe the mind is unsettled, it's scattered, it's unable to settle down, it's often confused. It's believing, you know, everything it's doing. So when you look at it closely, and as meditators we look at our experiences closely, when we turn our attention to doubt as an experience closely, what we realize is there's this da-da-da-da-da going on, but underneath it is some negative state, some state of fear or anxiety or some kind of resistance, some unpleasantness that we're wanting to avoid but we don't know how to do it. There's some negative feeling underneath that the thinking is trying to fix. Now this is the case most of the time. When there's a bunch of thinking, the reason for the thinking is to try and fix an underlying state of well-being. When we're in a state of well-being, it's quiet inside. It's why we prefer it. It's why it's a state that's wholesome, that's free from the busy churning of the little ego thinking. It's quiet, it's peaceful. And when it's more quiet and peaceful, there is the consciousness is uncluttered by all of that chattering, and that's what clarity is. So the hindrances are absent for a while when there's peacefulness. So on the other hand, whenever any of the hindrances are up, including doubt, there's activity going on. But underneath it is this feeling. We're usually caught on the thinking level. That's where we operate. That's what we notice. That's where we're engaged. That's where the words are, the story is, the drama is, the juice is. We're in there, in the thinking realm. As meditators, though, we're beginning to be able to experience feelings as well as just the thinking level. We're coming down underneath the story to what's also going on, which is the energy inside, the heaviness or the clutch or the pushing or whatever the more physical energetic experiences are. And they're unpleasant when we've got any of the hindrances going on. They're all unpleasant. Even wanting. We think wanting, ooh, I really want something. But when you stay looking at what that is and what that feels like, particularly when you can go, what if I didn't want that? What if I had that and then I didn't want another one? What would that be like? Contentment is way more well-being than wanting. Being satisfied is, which is actually what we want. We don't want the thing. We want that feeling of being satisfied. And we think that if we have a piece of chocolate, then we won't want anything. That's a fool's game, because of course, then we want something else, or another one, or, you know, it's never in the chocolate, it's always in here, right? So, but we can see from time to time when we're able to access or remind ourselves to remember having accessed the absence of the hindrance, we get to see the stress of the actual hindrance. So, underlying feelings under doubt. There's an old-fashioned term we don't use very much, but faint of heart. You know, when you have faint of heart, you don't have the heart. Or take heart. You know, this is not our common language so much, but when you tell somebody, take heart, you know, it'll be okay. When they don't have heart for something, I haven't got the heart for it, we haven't got the energy to deal with it, we doubt we can handle it. Our capacity to take the next step or do the deed, whatever it is just, we don't have, we're doubting. We doubt it's doable. We doubt we can follow through. We don't, I'm not going to be able to make it. Whatever mountain you're climbing. And someone who's cheering you on is like, you can do it. I can hear myself. I was a midwife, you know, for 20-something years. And I can hear myself. It's okay. You can do it. I don't just say, I would say that I don't know how many thousands of times. I would say, you are doing it. I don't think I can do it. You're doing it. That's doubting. I don't know how much longer I can do it. You'll just keep going as long as you need to, you know. Right? Anything, any situation that's like, oh no, I don't know I can handle this. That's doubt. I don't think I can sit for another minute. When is she going to ring the bell? You know, it's doubt. Right? Faint heart. The heart quails at the thought of something. I just these words just popped into my mind. I was preparing this talk. We don't use that word either, the quailing of the heart, but that's what doubt is, right? We've lost our enthusiasm. So I haven't yet got to these two words, but the two words which the absence of doubt, when doubt isn't there, is a sense of confidence and a sense of enthusiasm even. Confidence. It's along with trusting. Trusting I think of as trusting someone. But confidence is kind of is a sense of power, a sense of, I can, you know. I've got the energy for this. I can handle it. There's not faintness of heart there. There's like solidity, strength. Talk a little bit more about trusting. One of my, for a whole long time, several years, when I was practicing metta practice as a practice, as a formal practice. Anybody not know what I'm talking about? Right, same two people maybe. It's a form of well-wishing, which is formalized in the teachings of the Buddha, where you deliberately call up, evoke, 3 or 4, sometimes 5, wishes of well-being for yourself or for someone. And the first one of mine for quite a period of time was trusting. It was actually trusting goodness. I made it really vague because I absolutely trust goodness. I don't necessarily trust people, certainly not all the time, and certainly not some people, but I do trust goodness as that manifests in people. So my first phrase was trusting goodness. So we want to be able in our lives to be more clear, awakened, happy, contributing well people, more trust and less doubt in terms of this particular topic. So how do we access and develop and support senses of trust, especially all day long. It changes all the time, and something will happen. Something will come on the news, for instance, and it'll really shake our trust in people, in authority figures, let's say, things like this. So what happens when, what do you trust, actually, yourself, in your life, in general, first of all? We'll come back to meditation in a minute. So what are the things you trust? And you can always find out what you trust in is because where you actually put your money and you put your energy, you know, it's like where you engage in the world is stuff that you think is worthwhile. You know, that obviously is meaningful, and you trust that that's useful and rewarding in some way, you know, that's worthy of your attention. Where do you put your time and energy and money, I wonder? It's a good thing to ask yourself once in a while. Is your meditation on the edge after all the other stuff that you thought was really important, for instance? Your efforts, what's worth your while? Trusting is a state of the heart, as is doubt. It's a state, it's an inner state. And to open, when we trust, there's an openness. When we open, we're vulnerable. It's a vulnerable thing. Trusting isn't reliable in that it's not, okay, that's it, now I'm going to trust forever. We're very tender little beings. We're very vulnerable, sensitive beings. And we close in, and then we may be in a state of trusting, and then something happens, and someone says they look at us with a weird look, and whoop, you know, not so trusting. You know, suddenly there's doubt again, or some defendedness, or whatever. So it's fragile. It's not sort of stable riches. But we need to encourage ourselves so that, that's what the word means, take heart, cœur, French word, so that we can access more of this ability. In the state of withdrawn fragility, of fear, we can't be loving and wise. It's like the opposite. So obviously we know we're all here because we all want more well-being and we all want more kindness, so we need to be able to consider how do we access more trusting, for example. Well, I have a best friend. Many of us have a best friend. I trust my best friend completely. And I just think about my best friend and I relax. You know, it's like, because I know I can say anything. My friendship is absolutely not conditioned on anything I say or do. It's deeper than that. That's really something to trust. We've all got things like this, or people. So what's that like? Like, just think of something like that. It's like, oh, that feeling? Yeah. Now that, a few of you are smiling, so I know that you know what I'm talking about. There's something that you can rest in that. It can hold you. You don't have to do something. You can actually relax there, and something surrounds you in a way. You can, be held by, place your heart upon. I'm going to name a few things which are trustworthy in our lives. The body. On the whole, your body is pretty, and I don't mean the body to stay young and beautiful forever, because clearly they can't do that, but your body's understanding, it will show you really clearly if you're anxious, if you're tired, if you're sick, you know, if you're needy, if you're whatever it is, like your body will be telling you. It's like it can't do something, it can do something. It's very, that kind of physicality that is very reliable. If in doubt, ask your body, kind of thing. Yeah, in lots of ways, not in every way, but oftentimes. Trauma is lodged in the body. Memories of difficulty and so on are lodged in the body. It's the body that remembers fire is hot and trucks are dangerous and, you know, certain situations are reliable and certain other ones aren't. It's not, it goes right from the brain right down into the body. So you know what happens with little kids, you know. They just get it, and so they know, whoa, stairs are dangerous, watch out, you're a toddler. They're not going like, oh yeah, what was that I was supposed to remember about stairs? It's like, whoop, on are the brakes right there, right? The body's like that, immediate, reliable in lots of ways. This is not in any particular order of preference. There are just different things I thought of that evoke trust. When somebody tells the truth, truth and trust are the same root. When somebody says something that's really truthful, even if it's really unpleasant, even if it's about you and it's unpleasant, that just happened to me a couple of days ago. It's like, you're absolutely right. I hadn't realized it's true. There's something about that's like, yes. When somebody's being really honest, even if it's brutally honest, it's like there's a relief in it. And when they're not, and they're kidding, and they're saying, you look great, and you know you look like awful, you know, it's like, you don't, you kind of like it, but you don't really, because it's not the truth. Whatever it means. That's why lying is so devastating. That's why when people break trust, especially people in authority figures, where you've trusted naively, and they've, that's why it's, you know, the worst crime we know. That's a whole other huge topic, but you know what I'm referring to. You know, whether you're a priest or a doctor or a, you know, a parent, whatever it is, you know, the vulnerable who trust you. It's just devastating. Trust is very fragile and very precious, and it's very hard to heal when trust has been broken, as we all know, those of us who've had any form of shattering of that. Loyalty, the breaking of vows, deception, all these things. The Buddha made lying like one of the, you know, the biggest, when he talked about the five precepts of living with you know, care and honor so that you can meditate, you have to have some basic ethical boundaries about behavior, and lying is right up there in one of five ways of behaving. Because the power of breaking trust is, you know, lying, is just being deceptive is enormous. So, yeah. Oh, I'm just going to tell you a little story I wrote down here. It reminds me of this. You know, the trust of friendship, loyalty. When I was 11, I came across a book that was written by a Canadian, and I have no idea the name of the author. I wouldn't know if any of you would know this, but it's probably way long out of print. It was called Wild Animals I Have Known. Anybody? Anyway, it was Tales of the Canadian North, and here am I in a little boarding school in the south of England, and I found this book in the library and I read it. And each chapter was a certain adventure of some trapper person who lived way up in the north of Canada. And one, and I remember a few of the stories, God, and this one I'll never forget because it was about this topic, and he had befriended a wolf. And knew this wolf, and the wolf would come around from time to time, and he would feed the wolf sometimes, and somehow there was this bond between this man and this wolf. And he had a cabin way in the middle of nowhere. And at one point, which happened regularly from time to time, he'd gone. He was a trapper, that's how he was surviving up there and other things, and getting to know the wild and the animals. And it was such a nature book, and his immersion in, you know, love of the land and everything. He had to go off whenever he'd gone to the city or done his thing, and he'd been gone 2 or 3 weeks or something and came back. On the doorstep when he got back was his wolf, dead, with its foot in one of his traps. And he followed the trail through the snow and discovered that the wolf had dragged his trap something like 4 miles in order to get to him for help. And he wasn't there. I know, it was exactly like that. Oh, heart-wrenching, because of the trust the wolf had. Even though it was his trap that had killed him, he thought, if I make it to this human, he will help. And I just think of the poignancy of that degree of trust. It's so, isn't that, it's profound, trusting. It's the vulnerability of it, the delicacy of it, the honor of it, to have to take care of it. I'm getting a little away from hindrances and doubt, but anyway, I just wanted to share that because it's such a touching one. People, inspiring people. I mean, why do we go and listen, download Dharma talks by the million? You know, why do we like to go and listen to Desmond Tutu and read about the Dalai Lama and the thing? Because it evokes in us a sense of it's possible to be a decent human being. It's possible to be happy. It's possible to be really wise and really kind. And it's so inspiring. It evokes in us that. And of course, the opposite behaviors, when we see that, when we read about that, let's not go any further with naming names, it does the opposite, right? It just, it shakes our world and it's scary for us and so on. So you said, what kind of, so it's useful to think in terms of those who are inspiring, to those acts that are inspiring, to being honorable, to keeping to your promise and not letting people down, and when that happens and how good that feels, you know, and so on. Yeah, the ring of truth. Mm. And then another one for me, that's a huge one for me, because I didn't have a terrible childhood by any means, but I certainly didn't trust, there was absence of what, enough of what I should have had, and presence of what I shouldn't have had to some degree. And so for me, I grew up in this bucolic, gorgeous English countryside setting, a village full of thatched cottages, and nightingales and honeysuckle and all that kind of thing. I don't know what was going on behind closed doors, but it seemed to me, you know, as a kid, it was great, beautiful. And we had a lovely, huge garden. And we, in those days, this is the 50s in England, in a village. So we could ride our bikes and run around all over the place. As long as we were home for supper, no one was, you know, we didn't have to wear helmets. And we could go wherever we wanted, wander all through the fields and, you know, footpaths in England. And, all, and it was just like paradise. So for me, nature, the outside, is completely trustworthy. And the cycles of it, you know, and the sense in all the plants that they know when to throw their seeds at the right time, and the seeds know when they land on this ground, they will sprout. The reliability of the turning of the seasons of nature is unbelievably reassuring for somebody like me who prefer to trust that than people, because they're a little flaky or a little likely to change, whereas, you know, the eagles always come back in January, and the swallows always come back in March, and so on and so on. And I've had this family of swallows now nesting in my house for the last 3 years, and I get such a sense of, they've chosen my house again, and, you know. Anyway, those things for me are really important for bringing forth that quality. When that's there, that reassurance, then that little, like, voice is all set aside and calmed down, and that's a much more wholesome state. So that's general. But then there is doubt and trust in practice. Where are my next page of notes? So, those are some of the ways. How do we grow trust in practice, but how do we first of all extricate ourselves from doubt when we're practicing? So, the most initial, and of course, you're all meditators, you will do this all the time, is one, of course, is to recognize that there's doubt. Easier said than done, it's so sneaky. It appears to be so wise. It's so believable. We're thinking those thoughts, and no, I really am tired. No, I really don't have enough time. It's like, of course, it's really sensible. We don't recognize that it's doubting. Doubting that we've got the juice it might take tonight, or whatever it is for ourselves. That's one, of course. And then the other is, as soon as we begin have some mindfulness over this, and we're not lost in the story of doubting, it's like, okay, doubting. Then the next thing I hear Ajahn Sumedho's voice, what does that feel like? Turn towards doubting. Well, we don't want to turn towards, it's an unpleasant feeling. The reason we're doubting is because we're tired, or we're bored, or we're anxious or something, worried about something else, and so we can't meditate. So let's actually turn towards our immediate experience. That's, of course, what we've been taught a million times. What do you see there? What you see is a bunch of thoughts covering some kind of unpleasant feeling. Okay, go to the feeling. Let the feeling be known. Let the feeling be allowed. Let the feeling be felt. Feel it. It's the last thing we want to do. So we're using our thinking and all of our hindrances to try and protect us from feeling the boredom that's here, or the insufficiency that's here, or the need that's here, or the unworthiness, whatever it is. We're trying to avoid it by thinking. That's what the hindrances are doing, making us try and fix instead of be quiet and allow whatever is here to be. This is it. This is your life right here. So let yourself then feel the feeling, whatever it may be. Allow it. Behold it. Suddenly you're not doubting it. You're just welcoming it. It's like, oh, this is what's going on. Suddenly you're your caregiver and you're no longer doubting. It's so simple. And what helps is to remind yourself that it's not you. This isn't a story of you. This is energy. This is boredom. Or this is worry. Or this is simply doubting that's here. It's not an enemy. And it's not your fault. And it's nobody's fault. And there's nothing wrong. It's just an unpleasant feeling. That's it. So hard to do it, though. So this is a state of mind. This isn't reality. The story that's being told by your state isn't reality. This is a state of doubting that's telling a story that's not true. But we're out in the story level believing it. No, come back to the state. This is a state of mind. A state is doubting. The state is doubting and tired or worried or unsure or blaming or unworthy. Oh, I'm never going to be able to. That's what's going on. That's reality. The Dharma is reality. It's a state of mind. Okay. And then you can say, oh, thank you, doubt, for trying to protect me from feeling unworthy. But I'm going to feel unworthy. That's what I'm going to do. Let me be with this thing. Let me be anxious. As soon as you do that, doubt's gone. And there's now some confidence. I can feel this. I can turn to this. I can know this. I can even learn from this, for goodness sake. Fascinating. In a moment. Some of the other things that help with allaying doubt or extricating ourselves from doubt or growing trust as meditators, well, what's the very first one? Wondering why I haven't said it yet. The refuges. The whole reason the refuges are said first is to inspire confidence, is to allay doubt, is to bring our hearts uplifted, to kind of like fill us, take heart. This is doable. This is precious. This is what we're doing. Why are we here? That's why I did it when we first sat down. I said, why are you here anyway? Like, what is it that, why you want to sit on a Friday night? To remember that I actually want my mind to become clear and free. I want to train it so that I can recognize and release these murky hindrances that keep getting in the way of me and freedom and happiness and love and care. I really want this. Well, do you really want this? The more you really want this, the more you'll be able to see the hindrances and the more they'll evaporate. If you sort of half want it, you'll half see them and you'll half get rid of them. So you have to want them. So we need to do, the refuges are ways of like, what inspires me to practice? What juices me for this? What gives me confidence in it? Well, saying the refuges can give you a certain amount of confidence. Practicing itself is actually what gives you confidence, because as you practice, you find, gosh, I can tolerate irritating people like for 10 minutes longer. It's fantastic. I can sit here in this ridiculous traffic and I can get to the point where I'm suddenly told that the route you're about to take has been closed off, and I can go, oh, damn, now then, what am I going to do next? Instead of like, you get confident because the practice, you all have confidence. So those of you practicing for any length of time, you wouldn't keep practicing if you didn't have confidence that it did something for your life. Turn to that confidence. Remember the value of it, the impact of it. This is a thing I call using your insights. You actually remember them. Remember some of the, whatever the fruits are of your practice, the effect on your life, the way it's changed, the way you operate, and taste that again. And let that re-inspire you and motivate you to keep on being more present. You have to deliberately, can't just expect it to do it for you. You have to actually look and remember, and then you'll go like, this is fantastic. Or maybe you'll say, this is cool. Depending on how enthusiastic you are at the time. For me, you know, I've said to you, anyone who's heard me has heard me say this, I've said it so much. One of the most wonderful things about being a Dharma teacher, and particularly a retreat Dharma teacher, is to witness again and again and again and again and again people's confidence in the Dharma. Because they're saying, they noticed something and it was so helpful. And then they tell me and then they share it with me. And I see it over and over, the way their practice is transforming their lives. So I have my confidence for my own experience, which is great after all these years. I have huge trust in this process. But it's multiplied thousands of times because I get to witness so many other people becoming alight with this, you know, enthusiastic. Fabulous. It's for the biggest benefit of teaching it, I would say, with other people, you know, like when there's that exchange. And then there, so the refuges in the various ways people do remember awakening as possible. My mind can become a Buddha mind when I can be with things just as they are and not hinder them by wanting or resisting them or worrying, doubting, etc. And you know, being with honesty and true caring people just evokes a sense of connection and sangha. It's like so uplifting. That the way we want to behave, we don't want to be fractious and disconnected to people. We want connecting, honesty and kindness to flow between us. That's sangha. It's so inspiring of trust and helps us to keep practicing. And then there's, you know, whatever, for different people, and this is different people, this isn't true for everybody, some degree of devotion, some formalization, some beautiful statue, some rituals, which actually evoke a sense of trust and enthusiasm, bowing for some people, whatever it may be, surrounding yourself with flowers. For me, it's flowers more than statues. You know, whatever, you know, for whatever, a little altar with little thingamies. You know, I have a little love heart that my son found as a child somewhere and gave me. He's 40 this summer, but still I have this little thing. It's a little piece of carved stone where somebody made a little agate or something, and a little he gave me one time. Because it does that to my heart. It's uplifting. So I don't know what I'm going to say to finish. It's not a good sentence. 75%, I read this once years ago, of all religious practices of known world religions, I don't mean all of the, we don't know, you know, back in the jungle, things that aren't recorded, but the known world religions, 75% of them are devotional practices. Because of the evoking that sense of inspiration, you know. So, in whatever form that might be, you know, it's why there are a lot of authority figures who are adored, and we go to teachers because it brings forth that sense, you know. So, some forms of sacred places, sacred spaces, pilgrimages, because of what it does for us, you know, brings up that sense of trusting. The whole thing of holy sites and. Oh yes, I've got a little EG here, a lovely sweet thing. I was in Paris once, and in one of the, probably in Notre Dame, or I know, in some sacred place, being a tourist. And I was in there, and this young woman came in to the church, cathedral. And she was pretty fabulous looking, Parisian, elegant, you know, and all that. And she had a baby in a buggy. And she came in, and of course, Catholic churches, you have, I don't even know what they are or what they're called, but there's a whole lot of candles, you know, and you light your candle and you place your candle wherever, and there's a whole bank of lit candles, because this is a big, you know, this is, if it was Notre Dame or some such big cathedral, a lot of people. And so she came in with her baby, and she did her little thingamy and her little curtsy, and she stood there, and then she didn't have very long, she was obviously high energy person, you know, city girl. And then she turned the baby around and she lifted the buggy up so that this little baby could see all these candles. She wanted the baby even just to feel the sacredness of people's devotive candles. That was her little education for her kid to share that moment. And it was this adorable little baby. I was like, and then off she went back to her high fashion life, whatever she was doing, you know. It's like, wow, this sweet thing. What else? Intention. I mean, it's a simple word, intention. I like the word vision with intention. So it's something that inspires us, you know, something that can motivate us. So intention is really precious. Okay, I'm running to an end here. A couple of final words. The Buddha said, if it were not possible to free the mind of greed, hatred, and delusion, and hindrances, I would not tell you to do so. This is the Buddha. Like, take heart. He's like, it's possible. It's possible for every one of us. So don't let doubt undermine your practice, for instance. The Buddha, of course, said, this practice, this path is trustworthy. He said many things about it, but trustworthy, I just wanted to add to that. And then a couple of other little quotes I want to read you. One you're very familiar with, I'm sure. One you might not be so. Where is it? Page one. Where are you? going to find this. Excuse me, bear with me. Aha. This is Francis Bacon. If a man will begin with certainties, he shall end in doubts. But if he will be content to begin with doubts, he shall end in certainties. We think that doubt is wrong, because especially it's called a hindrance. Doubting isn't all a problem. To be able to tolerate doubting means we have some curiosity and some open space to learn something. But if you start off with trying to have no doubts at all and know it all, then that's going to get shaken up for sure. And so it isn't that certainty is the right thing and doubt is wrong, but we just want to recognize when we're hung up because of doubt. It's not that doubting itself or wanting itself or aversion in itself is a problem. It's just that if they hang us up and disturb us from being able to see clearly, then they're a hindrance. They aren't a hindrance per se. That's important to understand. And then I'll read the very famous one that all we good hippies had on our fridges. This is W.H. Murray, the Scottish Himalayan mountain climber, who said this about making the decision to climb the mountain to his crew. Until one is committed, there is hesitancy. The chance to draw back, always ineffectiveness. Concerning all acts of initiative and creation, there is one elementary truth, the ignorance of which kills countless ideas and splendid plans. That the moment one definitely commits oneself, then providence moves too. All sorts of things occur to help one that would never otherwise have occurred. A whole stream of events issues from that decision, raising in one's favor all manner of unforeseen incidents, meetings, and material assistance which no man could have dreamed would have come his way. I have learned a deep respect for one of Goethe's couplets. Now it's quoting Goethe. Whatever you can do or dream you can, begin it. Boldness has genius, magic, and power in it. We all know that one. I mean, it's really famous, but it's like, it's about trusting, and doubt is what is, isn't, you know, okay, doubt stops that. Okay, last is I don't even know where I got this, I'm sorry to say, so I can't give you an author, but it's actually, I think, very helpful. If we are spurred to act by elevating ideals, but lack the discipline to implement them, eventually we find ourselves wallowing in dreams or exhausting our energies in frivolous pursuits. It's only when accustomed routines are infused from within by vision that they become springboards to discovery rather than deadening ruts. And it is only when inspired vision gives birth to a course of repeatable actions that we can bring our ideals down from the ethereal sphere of imagination to the somber realm of fact. It took a flash of genius for Michelangelo to behold the figure of David, invisible in a shapeless block of stone. But it required years of prior training and countless blows with hammer and chisel to work the miracle that would leave us a masterpiece of art. The course of spiritual growth along the Buddhist path might in fact be conceived as an alternating succession of stages in which, during one phase, the element of vision is dominant, and during the next, the element of routine. It is a flash of vision that opens our inner eye to the essential meaning of the Dharma, and gradual training that makes our insight secure, and again, the urge for still more vision that propels the practice forward to its culmination in final knowledge. However, because our minds are keyed to fix upon the new and distinctive in our practice, we're prone to place a one-sided emphasis on vision at the expense of repetitive routine. Thus, we are elated by expectations concerning the stages of the path far beyond our reach, while at the same time we tend to neglect the lower stages, dull and drab, but far more urgent and immediate, lying just beneath our feet. The key to development along the Buddhist path is repetitive routine guided by inspirational vision. It's the insight into final freedom, the peace and purity of a liberated mind that uplifts us and impels us to overcome our limits. But it's by repetition, the methodical cultivation of wholesome practices, that we cover the distance, separating us from the goal and draw ever closer to deliverance. Thank you for your attention. I hope that there was something helpful there. I like the idea of creating a David. You know, that will serve me well. Okay, so we have a few minutes. It's 10 to 9, so I'm going to just go for a few minutes here and see whatever kind of comments, questions, what did this evoke in you, something that you found it helpful or anything. Questions, anything, please. Or if I went on so long, I put you all to sleep. Please. You're learning?
Learning how to draw.
Ah. Yeah. The discipline of it and the repetition of it and practice to refine
it. And the whole thing of doubt, it's like, well, should I do this or should I do this?
Yeah.
So I spend a lot of my time and I realize I'm wasting time.
Yes, we're wasting time. That's right. Thank you. It's a waste of time when you don't know. The thing is about it is that we're focused on the result and we forget to notice the state. And if you can remember that doubting, like everything else, is a state, watch that state. And then suddenly you're not caught in the doubting part. You're just interested. Oh, look at this, hung up. I'm really hung up. And then it can unbind like that. Yeah, thank you. Hi.
It's kind of time, because I've been working with the Indians just myself.
Yeah.
Always felt like doubt, you know, because the other ones, like you said,
yes,
have a countermeasure.
Yes.
Doubt that's kind of all by itself.
Yes.
I love that you brought the trust piece, which is kind of
that
missing.
Yes.
But then, for me, sometimes I feel like there's the trust and there's the faith. And sometimes they say it's the same, but I feel like there's differences. Do you see differences in
faith and trust?
Yeah, because faith seems kind of
more devotional, sort of.
Or is trust, you have that certainty that
you're Yeah. Saying. Well, I play around with words and the meaning for myself, and I explore what that means for me. And I often play around them when I'm describing them. So I'm interested in you asking that question. I don't use the word faith so much because faith has is so familiar in religious connotations for people, and it's got all kinds of baggage as well and all kinds of apparent understandings for people. It's used a lot. And so it therefore has got assumptions with it, or people's have beliefs built into what that actually means for them because they've grown up with something that has been given to them or something like that. So I tend to go more for the word trust. And I think partly because I think faith is described as a thing that we do somehow, and that's a well-known shared understanding, which then, when it's unquestioned, trust for me is more an experience that I can feel in myself, and I know when it's there, and I know what that feels like, and I know, therefore, when it's growing and what's inhibiting it, and so on, and so it's more experiential. So faith is more of a noun, and for me, trust is more of an experience. And so I tend to go for the experience. And so I tend to fiddle around with words till I can find a word that I can actually explore how it's manifesting in my experience. So it's not about which words. I mean, you have your own way, and you know, whatever works for you. But that's the way it goes for me. And that's why I play around with words. Yeah. Yeah. I don't know if that's helpful for you. But yeah. Hello.
I've always valued discernment.
Yes. Yes. Oh, very important. Thank you for bringing that up. So discern. Yeah. Sorry, don't mean to cut you off. Conscious of time. So discernment is wondering and checking and trying to make a healthy choice. You know, is this better than this, or this is good? And so it's the application of a certain amount of doubting so that we can then proceed in a skillful way rather than blinding along, you know, like where fools fear to tread. Fools rush in where angels fear to tread, something like that, you know, blind faith and all of that, getting into trouble, being naive. And so discernment is wisdom, for sure. It's a form of wisdom. It's like checking and making, you know, some degree of hesitancy, which is wisdom. It's just if we end up, just as the person in front of you is saying, you can actually waste a lot of time by like, well, maybe this, or maybe this, or maybe this. There comes a point where you actually have to step forward and do something. And so if the discerning is taking a long time and getting you so hung up, then it's becoming the hindrance. But until it's hanging you up and it's just simply slowing you down with some caution so you don't go blinding into danger, it's wisdom. So it's a matter of, it's a continuum. It's just like all of the hindrances. They're not in themselves a hindrance. A certain amount of wanting motivates us. I want to be kinder. I want some quiet now. You know, I want this. I don't want so-and-so. I don't want to go to that place and get all caught up in distraction and irritation. I don't, that's discernment. It's using them. It's this when our minds and therefore our lives and our behaviors and thoughts are run based on wanting without any recognition of that it's deliberately chosen, there's no choice, it's doing it for me, then I'm being hindered. My wisdom is hindered. If wisdom is functional, if mindfulness is present and my bigger, wiser mind is asking questions, then I'm not being hindered. The hindrance is when the desire takes over or the doubt takes over and there is no part of our brains able to make any choices, able to discern, and then it's become a hindrance. So it's kind of like when we lose, one of the ways that I see it and have taught it is that we've got two minds operational. There's the little mind that wants, that is aversive, that's worries, that whines and all that, is busy, struggling. And then there's this overview part of our mind, which we access in mindfulness, that's able to say, oh, wanting's happening. That's a good idea. That's not such a good idea. And so as long as that's operational, then this isn't running the show. But most of the time, with no mindfulness and with no meditation practice, we're the little mind. I love this. I hate, you pick up. I just picked up two more teenagers a couple of days ago. Oh, it's fantastic. I love this. I can't stand this. They're just full of love and hate, and they don't realize they're saying it. And so, you know, so there is no wisdom there. There's enthusiasm, but they're lost in the story. So it's like we get lost in the front end of the thoughts, whereas our wisdom is in the back end, overviewing what's happening. Well, we get hindered if we're lost in the wanting or the resistance or the agitation or the doubt. It's discernment. If we're not lost in it, we're using that wisely to run our lives in a wholesome way towards more harmony, more well-being, skillful, and so on. So, but that's because there's wisdom operational. Then it's not, you're not hindered. Yeah, yeah. Don't give the car keys to the kids. But most of us are kids, you know, getting in trouble, bumping into things and people. One more. Hi. Hi.
One thing that kept coming up for me was sort of the specific doubt of the spiritual seeker, which is the thought of happiness out there somewhere or enlightenment out there, and then some feeling or something will come up that's uncomfortable, and it seems like that has been taken away, or that's the doubt that is separate from
What's the last thing you said? You find that comes up for you a lot. That's really interesting. I can't remember your name.
Erin.
Erin. Hi, Erin. I recognize you absolutely. Nice to see you again. Yeah, I mean, there is, until we really have a moment of realization, we are actually hindered. And so doubt's going to be there, and we're going to misbelieve that happiness is out there, or that well-being is in the future after 100 retreats, or, you know, whatever the belief is, the beliefs are actually not the truth of things. So we're right to doubt those kinds of thoughts. And so that's going to be operational. And then we'll have a moment of realization of something, even if it's a little mini insight, or it's a bigger one, or it's a big moment of insight. And that all gets seen really clearly, and then it just is allayed. But we're mostly functioning erroneously. We're mostly functioning from the separate sense of self, which doesn't have faith, which is wanting and resisting. And that's what part and parcel of being in our duality is hindrance. I mean, that's what it is. That's kind of the definition of it. And in those moments when the sense of self separates, there's a sense of merging and interconnection, it's quiet inside, there's love, any of those moments, there's realization, then it's not there. And so, but you can't, it's not that that's wrong. That's actually the condition of being separate. And the condition of flashes of awakening and freedom is just a different experience. But through meditation and through training, we can start discerning, we can start observing that contracted state and the disturbed state and the confusions and the beliefs. And we can see when they're there and how they're there, and they start becoming dismantled, and we can see the factors involved. And that's what we're seeing just by simply being quiet and meditating. So the main thing is, it's not personal, and it's not right, wrong. It's just confused and therefore struggly, or not so confused and therefore free of stress. There's dukkha because there's confusion, or there isn't. And so, as Chogram Trungpa says, I'll end with this, Chogram Trungpa said, awakening, realization, is an accident. It means moments of, by the way. It's not like you are or you're not. Moments of. And meditation makes us accident prone. I want enthusiasm to meditate and become accidentally awakened. Okay, that's all I have for you this evening. So, Suze, thank you.